That mines Israeli forces fatally shoot two young Palestinians in the occupied West Bank a day after killing over a dozen during airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. Pakistan tightens security amid mounting tensions following the arrest of former Prime Minister Imran Khan. And a New York jury finds former U.S. President Donald Trump liable for sexually abusing and defaming an American former magazine columnist. Our top story for this half hour, Israeli forces have fatally shot two young Palestinians in a raid west of the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. The new fatalities came after the regime's forces carried out a raid on the town of Qabatiya, opening fire at Palestinians there. According to eyewitnesses during the raid, Israeli snipers took position on the rooftops while others raided a number of homes and destroyed people's property. The Israeli forces then closed the main streets in the town while laying siege to a number of houses. The regime has stepped up attacks across the occupied territories over the past months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank so far this year. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, says Palestinians are desperately waiting for the international community to take action against Israel for its crimes.
Every day, Israeli forces raid Palestinian areas, arrest people, destroy their homes, confiscate their lands, and kill people in cold blood. Not all of these Palestinians that are being killed by the Israeli forces are Palestinian fighters or members of the resistance groups. Many of those who are murdered are civilians, children, women, elderly. But at the end of the day, the international community is only issuing statements of condemnation, not more than this, calling the Israeli forces to stop their illegal, or even they didn't describe the practices as illegal. They are only demanding the Israeli forces to stop measures of aggression against the Palestinians. So the Palestinians do not expect anything from the international community or even the United Nations or even the Arab states. What the Palestinians really want, not a statement of condemnation, they want a serious position from the world to force the Israeli regime to stop their crimes. But knowing at the end of the day, as long as the Israeli regime is backed by the American administration, then they would continue to act as a state above the law. They would continue to keep reminding the Palestinians that they are under occupation and that they don't have the right to fight till the till ending this Israeli occupation.
The Gaza Strip is reeling from Tuesday's Israeli airstrikes that left at least 15 Palestinians dead and dozens more injured. The regime's warplanes targeted a number of places, including a residential building in the middle of Gaza City. The aerial raids also killed three commanders of the Islamic Jihad movement, along with their wives and children. Separately, Israeli forces targeted a vehicle in the besieged territory and assassinated two more members of the resistance group. A naval base in Gaza also came under attack by Israeli helicopters. The Islamic Jihad has told Press TV that the regime's latest massacre of Palestinians will not go unanswered. It has vowed to retaliate with a matching response, saying that Israel has committed a massive crime against humanity.
This is not only a crime against those who have struggled against occupation and have fought it, but it is also against innocent women and children. And therefore, this is a heinous crime. This is a massive crime against innocent people, against humanity, against all our people. And therefore, this requires that there be a retaliation, which is to the level of this massacre. There will be a united retaliation and a comprehensive retaliation. The retaliation, will be from all the factions, the resistance factions in Palestine. We have seen this. We have heard it from all the leaders and the commanders and spokespersons from the factions, and we have even seen this also by the coordination room, by the various political Palestinian resistance factions. And Hezbollah has said that they support this, and they continue to support, especially the coordination room among the factions of resistance in Palestine.
Condemnations have poured in over the latest strikes by the Israeli regime in Gaza. Iran's foreign ministry says the attacks show the regime's weakness in the face of the growing resistance of Palestinian youths. It stressed the Israeli regime needs to be held accountable and pay the price for the bloodshed. Syria also offered condolences, pledging to continue to support the Palestinian people and their cause. It called for action to put an end to the Israeli bloodshed. In Lebanon, Hezbollah stressed that the martyrdom of resistance commanders will only make the nation more determined to continue on the path of resistance. Hezbollah called the cowardice massacre of innocent women and children a crime against humanity. Also, the Jordanian Foreign Ministry urged the international community to prevent the Israeli regime from committing such heinous crimes. Four-party talks between foreign ministers of Syria, Turkey, Iran, and Russia are being held in Moscow to discuss the current situation in Syria. The top diplomats are to raise a number of issues, including the return of Syrian refugees, the fight against terrorism, and normalization of Ankara-Damascus ties. We're now going to cross over to Moscow to hear more on the meeting from our correspondent, Marina Kortunova, who is with us now from the Russian capital. Marina, what's on the agenda of the talks?
Good afternoon, dear colleagues. So 1 hour ago, Moscow began a meeting of the foreign ministers of Russia, Syria, Turkey, and Iran, Sergei Lavrov, Faisal Mikdad, Mevlut Çavuşoğlu, and Hussein Amir Abdullahian. The talks are taking place in one of the halls of the reception house of the Russian Foreign Ministry on Spiridonovka. I'm in the press center at the moment. So it is expected that during the meeting, the foreign ministers will discuss issues on the return of Syrian refugees to their homeland, as well as the fight against terrorism. The Turkish authorities will raise the issue of the return of Syrian refugees. And now, as you know, the Syrian authorities are not able to provide conditions for the return of refugees from Turkey. Lavrov, Abdullahian, Mikdad, and Çavuşoğlu meet in the light of attempts to normalize relations and eliminate contradictions between Damascus and Ankara, and the countries are participants in the Astana process to resolve the Syrian crisis. Also, as you know, in Moscow, in the end of April, talks were held between the defense ministers of the four countries. And the Syrian Minister of Defense then stated that the issue of the withdrawal of Turkish troops from the country's territory was discussed during the meeting. The Turkish Defense Ministry told that the parties discussed concrete steps for Moscow to normalize relations between Ankara and Damascus. If the subsequent results of the meeting are successful, a Turkish-Syrian summit should follow, but it is difficult to predict the results in advance, especially considering how long the parties have been going to this meeting in Moscow. In early April, technical consultations between the deputy foreign ministers of the four countries were held in the Russian capital as well, and they were also meant to produce the exact day and content of this ministerial meeting, which intends to facilitate the normalization of relations between Syria and Turkey. Yesterday, upon his arrival, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also expressed hope that the Moscow talks would create conditions for the return of Syrian refugees to their home country and the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. By the way, his talks with Mr. Lavrov will start 3 hours later. There will be talks also between two ministers. And yesterday, upon his arrival, Iranian foreign minister also pointed out that Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria. You know, there has been a huge job done before, during all these years. He pointed out for a four-party meeting with his counterparts from Russia, Syria, and Turkey, there have been a long process of negotiations. He said that diplomatic efforts of Tehran and Moscow aimed at preventing more military clashes on the Syrian-Turkish border made it possible to launch a negotiation process, this process which we see today in Moscow. So What else? During the protocol, the protocol pre-meeting, the journalists were allowed to present. The parties pointed out at the Astana format meeting in Tehran last year and that contradictions between Turkey and Syria are needed to be resolved politically. So Iranian foreign minister expressed hope that the Moscow talks would create conditions for the return of Syrian refugees to their homeland country and withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. I suppose Palestine issue will be also touched upon today's meeting because it is very difficult due to the recent events. It's difficult to avoid this topic. By the way, I think that's all by this moment. I think I mentioned all the most important issues which are going to be discussed. But the prolonged decisions of this meeting, we will know later. I suppose not even today and tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Marina Kartunova, joining us from the Russian capital, Moscow. Elsewhere, Chief of Staff of Iran's Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghdadi, has met with Sultan of Oman, Haytham bin Tariq, in Muscat to discuss security cooperation between the two countries. During their meeting, the Omani ruler and the Iranian general also discussed regional issues. Sultan Haytham called for mutual defense collaboration and said he would pay a visit to the Islamic Republic in the near future. General Baghdadi, for his part, stressed the importance of joint efforts by the two neighbors to boost regional security. He said the future world order would be based on multilateralism, adding that the global shift of power from the West to the Asia-centered region is imminent. Baghdadi held talks with other Omani officials during his visit to the country that ended on Tuesday. Well, in Tehran, the top Iranian general, Mohammad Baghdadi, on Wednesday addressed an international conference on the New World Order. He said Iran's Islamic revolution has been one of the pillars to fight the U.S. hegemonic agenda around the globe. The major general highlighted U.S. failures in several regional countries, including Afghanistan and Iraq, despite spending billions of dollars on its military adventurism. He said even Washington's traditional allies do not trust it anymore, adding that the U.S. is isolated more than ever. The top Iranian general also said that the U.S. power has diminished significantly over the past decades. The two-day conference has brought together thinkers, officials, and academics from some 37 countries. The topics such as new concepts in the formation of a new world order and its components will be discussed. Well, security has been beefed up around the police headquarters in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad, where former Prime Minister Imran Khan is under custody. Police say the extra measure has been taken ahead of Khan's scheduled hearing at the location since he will not be brought to court. The stage is now set for possible clashes between the police and Khan's supporters who are planning to march to the capital. On Tuesday, the former premier was detained from the High Court where he had gone to seek bail in multiple cases registered against him. According to the Pakistani, he was arrested by the country's National Accountability Bureau in connection with a corruption case. In response, Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party called for a nationwide shutdown. Scuffles also broke out between the police and protesters in different cities. Earlier, our Islamabad correspondent Nasser Qazvi joined us with details on the arrest of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, which is likely to deepen political instability there.
The violence and chaos has gripped Pakistan after the arrest of the former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan. We have confirmed reports that at least four people have been killed so far in clashes between police and protesters in different areas of the country, while more than 60 people have been injured, including 30 policemen during the clashes between the angry protesters and the policemen in Lahore, Islamabad, Karachi, and other cities of the country. There is no internet service since the arrest of the former Pakistani Premier Imran Khan, while the roads are closed, while all the schools and universities, colleges are shut down because of this chaotic situation in the country. There is no service, transport service available in major cities of Pakistan. So at the moment, there is a chaotic situation all around Pakistan. While the government is trying its best to control the situation, however, the leadership of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party is asking their supporters to come out in the streets and stage mass rallies all across the country. We have seen that the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party is trying to, they have announced that they will go to the country's top court to challenge the arrest of Imran Khan. However, at the moment, Imran Khan is in under still stringent security in police headquarters in Islamabad. While we have seen that the protesters are there is a call for the countrywide protest around at 2 o'clock in the evening today, and more violence and chaos is expected in days to come.
Manhattan federal court has found the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, liable for sexually abusing magazine writer E. Jean Carroll in the 1990s. Jurors decided that Trump should reward his accuser $5 million in punitive damages. That includes compensation for defaming Carroll. She's argued that Trump's public denials wrecked her career. The former president says a court decision is a, quote, disgrace. Trump will appeal the verdict. He says a trial is evidence of a, quote, democratic plot to tarnish his political image. Carroll has said she decided to break her silence in 2017 after rape allegations against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein prompted scores of women to come forward with accounts of sexual violence by powerful men. This just in, Palestinian medical officials are stating that one has been killed and another wounded in new Israeli strikes in Khan Yunis. In the Gaza Strip, we're going to keep you posted on the details of that story. Elsewhere, a new study shows half of the residents in the U.S. city of Chicago have been exposed to gun violence by the age of 40. The survey, published in the Journal of American Medical Association, was conducted on a sample of over 2,400 participants. The results showed the average of the participants were first exposed to gun violence by the age of 14. Also, 7% had been shot, while 50% had seen someone shot. The study also found that black people live in social contexts with far higher risk of seeing or becoming victims of firearm-related incidents. Also, separate studies suggested that young men in certain Chicago neighborhoods face a greater risk of dying from gun violence than U.S. military troops who served in Afghanistan or Iraq. The U.S. is among countries with the highest rate of gun violence. Almost 14,000 people have died from gun violence across the country so far in 2023. U.S. President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's meeting has failed to break an impasse over the U.S. debt limit. U.S. media say Biden's demand to Congress over raising the debt ceiling unconditionally was not accepted by the Republican team. Speaker McCarthy insisted that such a move should be accompanied by serious spending cuts by the U.S. administration. This as the Biden administration is running out of money. It could default on its debt as early as June the 1st if the debt limit is not raised or suspended by the Republican majority Congress. The Biden administration will be in economic turmoil. The U.S. federal debt has increased to almost $31 trillion in 2023. And that's a wrap for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Palestinians say the Zionist regime's siege on Gaza has crippled the enclave's economy. The fishing zone for the Gazans currently extends to only between 11 kilometers and 28 kilometers off the Gaza coast. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, "It is early morning, sunny but with a cool breeze. Jihad al-Hissi is busy helping fellow fishers to prepare a boat for a day at sea. There should not be anything unusual about the tasks they perform. Fishers around the world to them all the time. Yet the tension is almost palpable. Jihad 56 is worried that his boat will not return to the port. For 8 months last year, the boat was held by Israeli authorities after its crew ventured a short distance beyond the small zone in which Gaza's fishers are permitted to operate. Being away from the vessel was heartbreaking for Jihad. Feeding our families was very hard during those months," he said, adding, "All we know how to do is in life is fish." Eventually, the boat, named Al-Hajj Rajab, after Jihad's father, was released to him under strict conditions. He was required to pay approximately $5,500 and warned that he may not go further than 3 nautical miles from the shoreline. Jihad fears that the boat could be seized once again at any moment. The Israeli regime authorities have initiated court proceedings in an effort to confiscate the boat permanently. The ordeal began on February 14, 2022. On that day, Jihad's brother, Nihad, was captaining the boat. Nihad and other members of his extended family were lowering their nets into the sea when 3 Israeli regime naval vessels approached them at high speed. The Israelis attacked Nihad and his crew with rubber-coated steel bullets and water cannons. Once they were beside the boat, 3 Israeli regime commandos jumped on board, screaming and continuing to shoot. Nihad said, "They even used electric shock weapons on us several times. It was the most terrifying and cruel experience of my life," he added. "Not only because I was in danger, but because it was hard to see my sons and nephews injured and in handcuffs." All 6 fishers, including Nihad, were arrested and brought to Ashdod, a naval base in the occupied territories of Palestine. Later, the fishers were taken to the Erez military checkpoint, which separates the occupied territories and Gaza. They were interrogated before being released in the late evening. The excuse offered by the Zionist regime for its brutality was that the boat was outside the permitted fishing area. Nihad pointed out that it is often impossible to catch enough fish inside the permitted zone. Fishers have to go farther in the hope they will have a large enough daily catch. Otherwise, their activities would not be economically viable. Under the Oslo Accords signed between the Zionist regime and the Palestine Liberation Organization in 1990s, Gaza's fishers may venture up to 20 nautical miles from the shore. The Zionist regime has not respected the accords. The Zionist regime has repeatedly changed the limits applying to fishers. At times, this regime has reduced the zone as little as 3 nautical miles and even banned fishers from going to sea completely for certain periods. While naval attacks on Gaza's fishers are frequent, the court proceedings the Zionist regime has initiated against the Al-Hessi family is regarded as unprecedented. According to Gisha, an Israeli human rights group, the authorities are wrongly trying to invoke provisions of international law. These provisions concern the seizure of enemy ships and, in Gisha's view, should not be applied to civilians. It is deeply ironic that the Zionist regime is posing as a defender of international law in this case. The restrictions the Israeli regime has imposed on fishers and the violence to which this regime has subjected them constitutes collective punishment. That crime is outlawed by the Fourth Geneva Convention, a cornerstone of international law. Al-Mizan, a Gaza-based human rights group, has found that the Zionist regime carried out hundreds of attacks on Palestinian fishers in 2022 alone. Such attacks have continued in the first few months of this year. The Zionist regime's seizure of his boat caused major problems for Jihad. As he had no income, his debts mounted. And when the boat was finally handed back to him, it had sustained serious damage. Some of the damage resulted directly from the attack. Other damage resulted from the boat's engine being exposed to the elements during the 8 months it was kept in Ashdod. Repairing it cost approximately $11,000. Jihad also lost nets and other fishing gear that had been cast into the sea just before the attack occurred. Replacing the equipment cost an additional $10,000. Jihad had to borrow heavily so that he could pay those bills. While many fishers have left the profession since the Zionist regime imposed the full blockade on the Gaza Strip in 2007, Jihad is determined to keep plying his trade. He regards it as his duty to do so, as he comes from a family of fishers. He recalls hearing stories that his father told him about working as a fisher in Jaffa. The family hails from that port city in historic Palestine. They moved to Gaza after being uprooted during the Nakba, the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Jihad said, "Even when my boat was taken away from me, I insisted on going down to the port in Gaza every morning. Life away from the sea's breeze is unbearable." In the meantime, Wafa News Agency reported on May 1st, 2023, Israeli regime navy attacked Palestinian fishermen while sailing off the northwest shores of Gaza City, injuring 2 and arresting 2 others. According to the fishermen union committees in the Gaza Strip, 2 Palestinian fishermen were shot and injured by Israeli regime's navy's rubber-coated steel bullets, including an injury to the head. while sailing within 3 nautical miles offshore the northwest of Gaza City. Israeli regime navy troops reportedly surrounded the boat, attacked it with rubber-coated steel bullets and water cannons, shooting and injuring 2 people. They were taken to hospital for medical treatment. In the meantime, Israeli regime army and bulldozers on May 1st infiltrated Gaza borders from the eastern part of Khan Yunis city in southern Gaza Strip and razed land in the area. Sources said that 7 Israeli military vehicles accompanied by bulldozers raided agricultural land to the east of the town Khaza, east of Khan Yunis, where they leveled land and vandalized Palestinian agricultural properties.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Israeli regime has carried out a series of strikes on Gaza, killing at least 13 people, including 4 children. 3 members of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement and their families were also among those killed. The Ministry of Health says at least 20 others were also injured in the pre-dawn strikes. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have also intensified their crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the reasons behind this escalation. We have with us Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, joining us live from Beirut. Also, Chris Williamson, host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified, joining us from Derby, from the UK.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of Spotlight. Let's begin with Laith Maarouf. We have received different reactions from resistance groups, of course, all of them vowing to retaliate. Do you think that we could actually expect a united retaliation as it has been discussed? What kind of retaliation would that entail?
Well, we've heard statements by all the resistance groups in Palestine saying that they will be retaliating. So now we know at least inside Palestine there is a unified front. Much of Israel right now, at least the what is called the Gaza envelope, has been either evacuated or under lockdown. The schools are closed in the Zionist colony tomorrow. So what we should be expecting is... the same as the Zionists are expecting. The Zionists are expecting a heavy blow as a response to this treacherous assassination of Islamic Jihad leadership in Gaza, that it will be something that will be felt across Israel. There's even the bunkers in Tel Aviv have been opened right now. So this gives us a hint where we're going.
Okay, now before we discuss how Israel will react to that, let's bring in Chris Williamson. Mr. Williamson, how united do you see the resistance front in Palestine? We do know that the Achilles heel for any resistance would be to not be united in their fight for whatever the cause there is. And, of course, the divide-and-rule policy is something that has proven to work. The name of the game here would be solidarity and unification. And how much do you see that among different Palestinian factions and resistance groups?
Well, first of all, let me say that this is yet another brutal response by the Israeli regime. And, you know, it's a time for the international community to stand up and to speak out against, I mean, you know, this continuation of turning a blind eye is totally unacceptable. But in terms of the resistance, you know, from what I've understand the situation to be from the various programs that we put on Palestine Declassified, we know that there's unprecedented unity now across Palestine in terms of the resistance, the kind of axis of resistance as it's known, right across all the different factions. So, you know, one of the things which I think, you know, the Israelis are finding difficult to come to terms with is the effectiveness now of the resistance and the ability of the resistance to strike back. And I think we will certainly see a response from the resistance to this latest brutal atrocity by the Zionist entity.
Okay, so, Mr. Maruf, in your opinion, why does the Israelis attack, when they attack these targets, why don't they consider that there might be women and children there? Is this something that they do on purpose? They want to have women and children killed as well? Or is this some kind of collateral damage?
You know, the Zionists are brutal ghouls. They are blood-hungry. They talk about our peoples in our region as if they're tribal, but in reality, if you see how they purposefully target the family and children of leadership in Palestine, meaning that they want to cut off the bloodline of a family, that is the most tribal and most vicious thing you can do. Also, it is important to note that these three leadership of Palestinian Islamic Jihad were on their way to Egypt. They were invited by the Egyptian negotiators who are mediating between the Zionist colony and Palestinian groups in Gaza on the release of an exchange of prisoners. They were invited by the Egyptian government to arrive in Egypt today. And they were supposed to leave the Gaza border at 9 o'clock in the morning, meaning the Zionists knew where that they will be doing so. And the Zionists saw that they are gone to see their families, to say goodbye to them before they go to Egypt, and they took advantage of that and assassinated them. So this is as vicious as the assassination of General Soleimani, who also was arriving to Baghdad on invitation of for negotiations of peace. So this is what the Zionists do. And finally, one last thing to say here is one of the civilians that were killed, other than the children and women, was the general chief of Al-Wafa Hospital, a very famous doctor in Gaza who headed at one point the Dentist Association. And he's a dual citizen, a Russian-Palestinian citizen. This was a very, very vicious attack, and it will receive a response very soon from the Palestinian resistance groups.
So, Mr. Williamson, Netanyahu has just said that they are prepared for any kind of scenario. On the other hand, we do know that Tel Aviv is now warning settlers living near the Gaza Strip to stay close to bomb shelters in the coming hours because, well, obviously they fear that there might be retaliatory rocket attacks from Gaza. What does this mean when he says we are prepared for any scenario? If they have to go into shelters, that really doesn't mean to be prepared for a scenario. It just means running away from it.
Well, I think that's another indication, frankly, of the precarious state of the Zionist entity and the effectiveness of the resistance. We've seen and heard from very senior figures in the Zionist entity who have talked in terms of the regime and the whole Zionist edifice actually, you know, crumbling. You know, very senior figures, former prime minister have said that, you know, they fear that the Zionist project could end before the end of this decade. So I think, you know, the brave talk from Netanyahu, but I mean, the reality is that, you know, the tide of history is against them. The effectiveness of the resistance is growing. International opinion is increasingly critical of the Zionist regime. And I think that, you know, the writing is on the wall, frankly, for a substantial change and the, you know, the fortunes of the settler colony there is very much in doubt now. And, you know, what we need now, of course, though, is to push our politicians in the West to actually, you know, recognize that they are supporting the last brutal apartheid regime on the globe. And, you know, we know that there was a huge opposition around the whole of the world in opposition to the apartheid regime in South Africa. And that was, you know, in the end supported by Western countries who previously fallen in line and supported the South African regime. And I think, you know, given the strength of public opinion in all Western countries now is moving in favor of the Palestinian cause and Palestinian liberation, will force the politicians to change their tune and to actually recognize that they, you know, they need to be supporting a change in the whole situation there, which is completely untenable and has been going on now, as we know, for 75 years. Completely appalling. And, you know, we've got to keep the pressure up. That pressure is happening on the ground in Palestine, of course, but we need to be doing what we can outside of Palestine to continue to support the resistance there.
So, Mr. Maruf, these strikes in Gaza, where does this leave Egypt as a country that has been trying to mediate? You just brought up the name of Egypt, and you did mention that negotiations were supposed to be underway before this happened. So where does that leave a country like Egypt who's trying to solve the issue through diplomatic means? Then you see such kind of reactions from Israel. You have a long list of UN resolutions that are being neglected by the Israeli regime, not to mention that most of the actions by this regime are against the international law and international conventions.
Well, clearly the Egyptian government had made a statement condemning this assassination. We know that the Egyptian negotiators were really upset and sent a stern a response to the Zionists. They know that they have been put in a really bad situation now. The groups in Gaza now can refuse the negotiation efforts of Egypt. Since the morning, the Egyptian government has been trying to outreach to listen to Islamic Jihad, clearly to maybe ask them to not retaliate, but they have not been getting any responses from the listen to Islamic Jihad. And remember, Egypt, like the rest of the Arabic League, we're moving towards ending hostilities between Arabic states and realigning themselves together with Syria and having a separate foreign policy, as we see the Saudis are attempting to do that too, from the United States and Israel. And already Egypt is in the heat right now with the manufactured war in Sudan that the Israelis and the Americans instigated to make sure that even if Egypt at one point decides to
have a sovereign foreign policy that it will not be able to deliver on it, having a ring of fire spanning from Libya to Sudan, cutting it from its surrounding and making its economy suffer with millions of refugees coming from Sudan.
Okay, so, of course, the regional developments are also very important in considering the situation in Sudan as well. We will discuss that later. But meanwhile, Mr. Williamson, do you think that Israel has left any room for diplomacy with its actions? Or have we reached that point of no return where it is now proven to any observer that once and for all that the only way to fight against Israel is the resistance of the Palestinian factions, and there is actually no room for diplomacy left?
Well, I think that's been the case for a good number of years now. I mean, the Israeli regime has always negotiated in bad faith. We saw that with the Oslo Accords. The reality is that they were never interested in self-determination for the Palestinian people. But the tide, as I say, is turning. And, the resistance is becoming more effective. The BDS campaign is ratcheting up. We've seen now the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran brokered by China. China is now a much bigger player on the international diplomatic scene, as it were, taking the place, frankly, of the United States of America, which, historically has always been supportive of the Zionist entity and continues to be so, bankrolling them to the tune of over $4 billion every single year. But the U.S.'s influence on the international scene is certainly waning. There is a new world order developing. We're seeing different powers coming together. The link between China and Russia and Iran and other major players coming together in the BRICS, as it's known. And this is, I think, a very significant development, which can only augur well, I think, for the future in terms of a multipolar world. We're moving away very rapidly from the unipolar world. I think the unipolar world is gone anyway. Now we are already in that multipolar world with, as I've already mentioned, the influence of China now. And the interesting thing is, China approaches its foreign policy developments and the way in which it conducts itself on the international stage, does it in a way to try and, bring about peace and to try and, as it were, mutually developed nations rather than the sort of gunboat diplomacy that we've seen from the likes of the United States of America and the United Kingdom and others in the Western world. And things are definitely changing, in my opinion. But as far as diplomacy is concerned with the Zionist entity, I think they've never negotiated in good faith. And I think they need to be forced, frankly, now to bring about the change. And as I think, that's already happening, as we've already said, with the resistance on the ground and pressure building from outside as well.
So, Mr. Maruf, you just heard Mr. Williamson's analysis of the recent developments as far as the political equations of the region is concerned, and, of course, with China playing a more important role in the region. And how do you see the situation of Israel in the near future, maybe in the next 10 years?
Well, hopefully it will not be in existence in 10 years. It's clear that we are at the beginning of its collapse, and that comes, of course, coupled with the collapse of American hegemony and imperialism. Remember, I just want to put this out here. I don't think any pressure will change the minds of the leadership in the West about the Zionist colony. And that is because if the Zionist colony collapses, then the Western Empire will not be able to project its power over Asia and Africa and control the trade routes that are important there. It will be actually an acceleration of collapse of American imperialism. And this is why somebody like President Biden years ago said that if there was no Israel that was created by the Zionist movement, that the United States would have created it itself. So given those realities, we must understand that the only way to liberate Palestine is through direct confrontation with the Zionists and collapse of it under the pressure of resistance. There's nobody that's going to come to save the Palestinians, and there will be no Western negotiators to bring down the Zionists from the tree. This will be a battle to the end, and this is very important to understand, because if the Zionists were rational, or the imperialists were rational in terms of this issue, then we wouldn't see actions like we saw today. The clearer and closer we are to the liberation of Palestine, the more and higher possibility there will be of irrational actions by the Zionist colony and its backers, and as we see that happen today.
And of course, let's not forget that Israel has been raiding the flashpoint city of Nablus, or the raids on Ariha, other parts of the occupied West Bank. So, Mr. Williamson, why is Israel attacking these parts of the occupied West Bank as well? Is it trying to deviate attention from its internal affairs?
Well, I think certainly that is part of the reason. I'm sure it is. But also, of course, that, you know, they want to try and crush the resistance. But it's a forlorn proposition. I don't think they're capable of doing that. And, you know, we've seen how the resistance pushed back the Israeli ground forces a couple of years ago when they were seeking to another incursion into Gaza, and, you know, the resort to these brutal air raids. But, you know, I do think that external pressure does have a part to play. Of course, in the end, Palestinian liberation will be delivered by the resistance on the ground. But I think external pressure can play a part. And of course, the imperialists who hold sway across the West at the moment are determined to, you know, maintain that position for the reasons that Maruf outlined. And we saw what happened when, for example, Jeremy Corbyn, who the leader of the opposition, the Labour opposition Labour Party in Britain, was within a hair's breadth of becoming the Prime Minister. Massive effort was put into destroying him and destroying his supporters. And, you know, that whole Corbyn legacy now has been utterly destroyed now within the British Labour Party. The Labour Party is nothing like it was under Jeremy Corbyn's tenure, because Jeremy did threaten that world order. He was somebody who was very supportive of the Palestinian cause and had been for decades and has spoken out numerous times in the Houses of Parliament in Britain. He was also in favour of peace on the world stage. He appointed a Minister for Peace and Disarmament, and, you know, we'd have had the prospect of Britain being a permanent member of the UN Security Council, promoting peace and disarmament around the world rather than war and arms sales. And that was unconscionable. Even Mike Pompeo, you know, the Secretary of State in the US, said words to the effect that, you know, they would not allow Corbyn to become Prime Minister. So there was certainly external interference there. So, yes, of course, the imperialists will do whatever they can, but the pressure is growing from the populace, as it were. And, you know, and these politicians are subject to election in these so-called Western democracies, and there is every prospect. I know that the Corbyn project was destroyed, but, you know, those people that were inspired by that haven't gone away. And so there is the prospect, I think, of getting new politicians elected to bring about the sort of revolution that, you know, we were hoping for under Jeremy Corbyn. And that's being replicated, you know, right across Europe and indeed in the United States of America as well. So I'm not, you know, totally pessimistic about the role of external pressure. I think it has a role to play and can actually help to hasten the demise of the Zionist entity. But look, as I've already said, you know, when you've got people like Naftali Bennett, the former Prime Minister of Israel, talking about, you know, the precarious nature of the Zionist entity, and other senior figures, you know, predicting former Prime Minister Barak talking about, you know, being ended within 10 years. I mean, they see the writing on the wall, it seems to me. So, you know, we need to obviously support the resistance wherever we can, and those of us who, you know, are not in Palestine, continue to put pressure on the policymakers to do whatever we can to, you know, up that and increase that pressure, that external pressure. Because that did, let's remember, play a part. That external pressure did play a part in actually bringing down the apartheid regime in South Africa. So, you know, we shouldn't be totally pessimistic about that, but we need to be realistic, I think, as Maruf has set out, but not actually give up on putting pressure, external pressure, to hasten that demise of the Zionist entity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chris Williamson, host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified, joining us from Derby in the UK, and also Laith Marouf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. Thanks for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight and sharing your thoughts and views with us. That brings us to the end of this edition of Spotlight.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali, al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam lived under the wing of his father, the eighth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, for a relatively short period that was not more than 7 years. However, at this young and tender age, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam displayed intelligence and talents that truly astonished the minds of great thinkers. And like his father, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam had been impressed with the greatest of virtues and the highest of morals, the most profound of knowledge and wisdom, and his eternal values became as torches of guidance and awakening in the whole of the Islamic society.